Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for May 18th, 2011. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. In it, I have an interview I recorded with Tiffany Rad. She's a hacker, an educator, and a lawyer. She's also co-founder of Reverse Space, one of the newer hacker spaces here in the DC area. And we get to talking about what hacker spaces are, in case you don't know, as well as the kinds of things they do, the value they bring to the communities they are embedded with, how that overlaps with her background in education, and also how it fits in with the larger world of hacking in general. We get a little bit into some of the security conferences and some of the work and advice and panels that she's done there. All very fascinating stuff. Can't wait to share that with you. Because of the length of that, there is no new hacker word of the week. Also, before we get started, I do want to give you a heads up on my next bit of scheduling on the podcast. I will be going to Balticon over the Memorial Day weekend, as I've hinted in a couple of episodes leading up to now. But more specifically, that means on Wednesday the 25th, there will not be a feature cast, as I will be preparing. I need to prepare for a couple of panels that I'll be on at that convention. And also Sunday the 29th, there will be no newscast that evening because I will be at the convention. However, I will be reprising two panels from previous years, one on copyright, one on open source for everyday use, and I will hopefully be getting good quality panel recordings to bring back to share after Balticon, so I'll be able to keep up with feature casts immediately following the holiday weekend. And then I actually have some travel, not the next weekend after that, but Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday for the Personal Democracy Forum. I'll talk a little bit more in detail about that in the show after Balticon, the Wednesday after Memorial Day. I'll give you a heads up on how that is going to affect the podcasting schedules. So there should be a newscast this Sunday, so I'll be able to catch up with you then. There's a very slight chance that things may go a little crazy on other fronts, mostly on the homebrewing front, that might prevent that, but that chance is very small. And if you're concerned or you don't hear from me, just check the website. And as always, I'll update any last minute stuff that I won't have a chance to talk about, obviously, between now and then. Tiffany Rad is a hacker, a professor, and a lawyer. She has presented at a variety of hacker conventions, including Black Hat. Most notably, though, she is very active in the hackspace scene. She's co-founder of Reverse Space, a new hackerspace here in the DC area. We've been acquainted online for a while now, as she's been making connections online in support of Reverse Space. Recently, I got a chance to meet her face-to-face at Public Knowledge's 3D DC event. I was immediately impressed with how she brings all of her expertise to bear on her efforts, working as an educator using hackerspaces as tools for teaching while maintaining a keen awareness of the legal issues that often arise. Welcome to the show, Tiffany.
Thank you very much. What a generous introduction.
My pleasure. Can you explain a little bit more about your background? How did you come to combine these three areas of education, hacking, and the law?
I've been in education for quite a while. When I was getting one of my graduate degrees, I taught at a high school, and this was a high school that my mother owns. That's fairly different than traditional high schools, both private and public, that are in the Northern Virginia area. All the kids are legally homeschooled, so I know in a sense that's it sounds a little bit like an oxymoron, but the children would go to school and hours at which it was, their parents or they chose. And they'd also choose most of their classes, but yet also getting the classes that are necessary for a high school degree from them that's granted by the American school. So it's a tutoring firm. And I really enjoyed teaching for this tutoring firm because a lot of the students are fairly motivated because they're just excited to be in there and do some work. Some of them are only in school for 3-4 hours a day. It's not like the full 8-hour day that a lot of schools have, but I started teaching biology there during one of my graduate degree programs when I was right out of college. And that was when it was in the back offices of an engineering building and or an engineering company in Reston, Virginia. And now I think it's been quite a few years later, and they purchased a building, and inside that building, half is the school and half is the hacker space. And the kids have access to the equipment and a lot of the projects as well that the Hackerspace members are sharing during the daytime, like from 8 a.m. to like 5 p.m., whatever students or teachers are there. They may use the equipment in the space. And from about 5:30 p.m. until 10 p.m., most days of the week, and we're open quite a bit on weekends, that's when the Hackerspace members can use the space. So we kind of found it interesting to combine education and kind of like an interest in motivating people to do more work with technology and learning how things work by taking them apart, figuring out where there may be engineering or design flaws, and then working toward redesigning or designing better solutions to things that we've discovered. So that's how I got into education, and how when I started attending Hacker Spaces, I thought it would be a really great idea when we purchased this building to combine the two.
For the benefit of listeners who aren't familiar, can we back up a minute and maybe have you explain a bit more about Hackerspaces, in particular, how Reverse Space fits into this larger realm of convening places for makers, DIYers, and hackers?
Sure. Hackerspaces are, there are other definitions for them, innovation spaces, maker spaces. They're a place where people can come together and a fairly, most of the spaces are very opening, open to new members and people from the public coming in for particular days or project days that they have going on. But they're places where people can congregate to work on technology projects or to use equipment that you can't either afford, you know, one person on their own, like a 3D printer is quite expensive. So you find a group or a company or someone who's willing to host this type of space. And you can share equipment. And there are some members we have in our space that they can't have, for instance, some bigger tools in their apartments, places like that. So they come here to use some of the equipment that we're some of the bigger stuff we're getting at Reverse Space as well. So as a Hackerspace, Makerspace is where people work on projects and they share their knowledge and they want to, most people are there to teach others and about different types of technology. And it's really a place where you can go to learn. So it's sort of like a school outside of school for those of us who have been out for a while, or it's a great place to go to talk to people about what's going on in technology and work on projects and learn new things.
So it's pretty clear that your interest is then continuous with what you described in terms of your entree into the education space. What makes them of such interest as opposed to other more traditional venues for both the kinds of non-traditional teaching that you were talking about in teaching environments? And also, are they just as valuable to more traditional schooling?
They are. I think it's as valuable as traditional schooling. We have students who do come in with their parents for liability reasons during the Hackerspace hours, and they work on projects with their parents. And I think it's valuable for that as well. One of the disappointments I remember from high school is that there was shop, and then there was like a place where you could work on cars. But for instance, it just didn't... They phased a lot of those out of the schools, at least in the Fairfax County and Loudoun County areas in Northern Virginia. For liability reasons, they've taken shop out of a lot of schools, and I think that's really disappointing. So this is filling a bit of a niche that the public schools have removed. We haven't quite done it yet, but we're setting up a biology and chemistry lab as well. And I've been told that a lot of the chemistry labs in Fairfax County have removed Bunsen burners, and they do more theoretical experiments, again, because they're worried about liability. And I think that's too bad, because it's kind of great to see a project or an experiment go from like beginning to end and actually be able to be a part of it, not just read about it or watch a professor do it and have to sit and watch. The Hackerspace and the school that we have is really more about putting more hands-on learning into education. And we think that a lot of the high schools of recently, well, and actually junior high and elementary schools too, have removed that element from their curricula. In fact, I'm one of the founders of a conference called HackKidCon. It's a hacker kids conference, and we do a lot of the same stuff. We do it at a hacker space, but it's just for kids. And we did it up in Boston October of 2010. And we are doing some projects, like we taught kids how to solder. there are a lot of schools that won't teach kids that because they're afraid of people getting injured or parents complaining about the smell, and it's unfortunate. So we're trying to do more hands-on learning or augment that for the kids who are in the public and private school, traditional schools around here.
Do you have any sort of a curriculum in addition to providing that space, or is it all much more open-ended?
For the high school students that are a member of the associated school, school tutoring firm, which is called Cortona Academy, they do have a sort of an augmented curriculum. They're still using a curriculum called the American School Curriculum for high school. A lot of homeschoolers in the United States use that. I used that when I was homeschooled during high school. And it's this same curriculum that it's pretty basic, but it's the one used by the American schools overseas for, embassy kids and stuff like that. So it's a good basic curriculum for the basic studies, math, English, history. And then in addition to that, we bring them into the space, and we have programs that we're running for them. In fact, one of the students, you may have seen it at the 3DDC event that you and I attended. One of the students has decided that there needs to be a new type of electrical outlets, and he, whether that's going to happen or not, we encourage him to kind of research a lot about electricity and physics and get into some of the engineering principles of, well, how would you design a better plug? What would it look like and why? And so we took some of the CAD drawings and we put them in the 3D printer, and we made a prototype for him of the device that he thought would make a better plug. And a lot of this was inspired through the traditional, very basic physics course and some of the other science courses that American School offered. But we changed a little bit of the American School's curriculum and said, okay, well, now you've done that work, and let's do a little bit more. Go beyond just what you're reading in the textbook and build something that you've designed. And that's the type of thing that we do at the school, that having the hackerspace and that equipment there is a really great resource.
It sounds like innovation's something that you try to cultivate. Do you, or have you worked with like STEM Week? I'm thinking in particular, I took my own kids just to the regular school here in the county for a STEM Expo a few weeks ago, where there was a little bit, not to the degree you're talking about, but a little bit more exposure to kind of hands-on science, technology, engineering, and math.
Yeah, I know that some of the counties here, well, every county I think in Northern Virginia has a special magnet school that is for students. They call it students who are gifted in science, technology, and mathematics. I think in Fairfax County, I can't remember the name of the school, but it's not only a long bus ride for a lot of the kids on the edge of Fairfax County, and I'm not sure even where Loudoun County's is, but the public school system does offer some schools that do highlight this, so they do have the same type of equipment that we do. However, how they define gifted, which is PSAT scores that are taken during junior high, we have a different idea of what we'd like for the kids to learn. At Cortona Academy, my mother, who's the director of the school, and my brother is also one of the directors right now, they don't take stuff like PSAT scores and only take kids who are highly gifted in math and science. They really want to get all kids of all different levels and interests and try to get them interested in doing more in this type of work. And they don't look at the giftedness or non-giftedness of the students. It's really they work to the student's potential. And that's something that we've always supported. And in the hackerspace, it's the same thing. To tell someone like, oh, you're a hardware engineer, computer hardware, you're not going to really understand the software. That's not the type of spirit that we want to, cultivate there. We're trying to get people to get into other types of fields like microcontrollers. We have a microcontroller day where it may be something totally brand new to them, and we're okay, and everyone's okay there with people saying, hey, I've never done this before, but I want to learn. And that's the type of thing that we're trying to get some of the students to open their minds. And in fact, we haven't done it yet because the technology right now is a little bit expensive, but there's some students interested in filmmaking and computer graphics related to the stuff that's in the movies, and they're working on some projects now to do that type of work. So it's not just straight up programming computers, electronics that we're doing at the hackerspace. We have groups of people who are interested in that as well, like filmmaking. So it's and we have artists too. So having a space like that where it's just a collaborative group, where if you are interested in something and you think other people are too, you post to the group and say, hey, I want to set this up. Anyone else want to, learn how to program this in this language with me, or anyone else want to work on this computer project or on this art installation. I think they're working on a big art installation right now, actually. A student from a junior college here needed some help with soldering, a lot of soldering. So some of the members got together on weekends and just sat down and helped him build it. So it's that kind of thing where I'm really happy with a lot of the communication and the willingness to help that goes on within the hacker spaces and in the hacker community in general.
On the flip side to those sorts of advantages and benefits, that very positive picture you paint, I am curious whether you've encountered any resistance or pushback either from parents. I mean, you were talking about concerns over our liability, or from other educational institutes.
Yes, indeed. Sometimes there is, and this is one of the challenges associated with putting the name hacker into any type of company name or business objective. We named the hackerspace reverse space because on its face, especially when you met me at 3DDC, explaining to, you know, congressmen and senators, hey, this is a hackerspace. You know, we're more of an asset to the U.S. government than to be feared. That type of thing. When the name hacker is associated with it, it still has some negative connotations that are fed by the press and the media, I think, who it may sound more exciting to paint up hackers in general as being like bad and, you know, malicious, working on bad deeds. But I think for the most part, it's really about people who are interested in technology and taking things apart and figuring out where their vulnerabilities or flaws and either sharing them in interest of making, you know, things more secure, or in fixing them themselves and giving them to the companies. I've seen it both ways. I think that the malicious element is actually quite negligible, and especially in the hacker spaces, I have not seen anyone intentionally going out and breaking stuff. Because, well, it's just like any other group. If someone breaks things, everyone loses. we do have a lot of policies at our space about, we log a lot of the traffic that's going in and coming out of the hacker space. And we just are trying to be sure that people don't really push the envelope with some of that, because it can ruin it for everyone. And we have had some pushback about, yes, we're a hackerspace type of thing, but for the most part, for the parents in the school, they walk in and they see just these couches for people sitting together and working on projects. We had some lab tables where I was setting up the biochem lab, and it's a group of people really who are just interested in just hanging out and working on projects. So far, we haven't had issues with the parents. They've looked at it more as like, this is a great thing, you know, for the high school kids to use during the day, than, hey, this is a hackerspace. This sounds like my kid could be learning dangerous things here. No one has actually said that. At first, we were concerned, but it has not happened. So that's some of the pushback, I think, that we were concerned about, but it really hasn't been a big problem.
So would it be fair to say that you see the role of reverse space as much about advocacy as well, about bringing that education not just to the students and to their family, but out into the community, like what you were talking about in rubbing elbows with Congress critters at 3DDC, but also bringing attention to technical issues around consumer goods the way that perhaps open source in a similar fashion does for proprietary software?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the hackerspace movement in general does that. And a very strong proponent of the hackerspace movement is Nick Farr. He was one of the founders of HackDC, which one of the first hackerspaces, I believe, in the U.S. And actually, I went to his hackerspace probably about 3 years ago and said, this is fantastic. You know, I wonder if we could have one of these out in Northern Virginia, because it's kind of far to drive into D.C. from out near Dulles Airport where we are. And there are a lot of people, when I said I'm interested in doing this, they said, yeah, let's all get together. Let's talk about how, you know, we can help each other, you know, set up different hackerspaces. And I think there are hundreds now in the United States. And I think that it's definitely something that's been fun. It's been challenging, just like setting up any other type of company or group, from both legal standpoint, insurance at times, and from funding and buying equipment. It's running a business. That's really what a hackerspace is like. But I think that the advocacy is very strong within the hacking community in general, and especially in the hackerspace movement. We don't just have presentations about this is how you learn, you know, this new programming language. There are discussions about policy and law and, you know, politics, especially since we have established a cyber war simulation center. We often talk about, you know, government's role in these types of legislation that's coming up. You know, how much of a role should government have in being able to cut off pieces of the internet, like the kill switch, you know, specifics that are in the press right now. And we have these discussions at the hackerspace. So it's not just strictly about technology. It's about policy, advocacy. And that's one of the reasons why I did the 3D DC event on Capitol Hill.
What informs that policy interest? That seems like it seems a little unusual, although it is in the D.C. area. Is it being that close to the nation's capital? Is it your background in particular or something else?
I think most hackerspaces do, in fact, have policy advocacy groups. And in fact, I was having this discussion just the other day. A lot of what goes on within the hacking community, a lot of the innovation and technology, developing new technologies, or including breaking some of the technologies that were at one time considered, you know, for whatever reasons, to be the most secure devices, most secure networks. Finding vulnerabilities in these things, you're really kind of working in some sense legally and at times ethically in the gray area. So in some sense, the type of hacking that is being done, that is, I believe, improving security when the results are, you fix it or you tell the vendor or, you know, whatever you do about that. But finding these vulnerabilities and sharing them and learning about how not to do it next time, that does take some policy and advocacy. And in fact, I often am asked legal questions about how do I share this information? I'd feel irresponsible not telling the vendor about security vulnerabilities, but I don't want to quite, make them really upset. I'm afraid of the, you know, criminal or civil ramifications of that. So the hacking community and the hacker spaces, I think because a lot of the work that goes on there, it's not that it's illegal work. You know, I don't want that to be misunderstood. It's just that you're really kind of pushing the envelope on some of the research that's being done. It's cutting edge, just like it would be at a place like similar to NIH or Howard Hughes Medical Institute. When you're working in any type of space where you're finding problems and you're solving problems, you are going to need the policy people and the attorneys to kind of back you up in the work that you're doing or talk to you before the work is done so perhaps you can change different parts of how things are done so that when you do release the information or if you do, that is a different ethical decision and a choice, that you can do it in a way that protects you and other people and just in a safe, legally and ethically safe way. So I think that the hackerspaces, a lot of them, they do have a lot of policy interests. There are some laws, as what we were talking about at 3DDC with intellectual property, that make some of the work at the hackerspace you're doing, you can be doing, complicated, like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And I can talk a little bit about that if you'd like, but it's one of these laws that if you really need to understand both the licensing of the device that you're copying or taking a look at when you're doing 3D printing, and if you have to break any technological measures, such as breaking a piece of encryption to see how a piece of code works. A lot of that does go on in hackerspaces, and if it's for research, it's one thing. If it's for commercial purposes, that's another. Those are the types of things that hackerspace members think about as they're working on these projects.
I would actually like to delve into the DMCA a little bit more because this is an area I think that many listeners may not think about as much. A lot of the news stories that I discuss from week to week with not just the DMCA, but now we have the successor to the ill-fated and controversial CUECA. We have the Protect IP Act that gets into not so much the anti-circumvention that you mentioned that's built into the DMCA, but does get into questions of enforcement and can make these areas fraught. But from your perspective, the fact that you're dealing with devices may not occur to a lot of people that there is a circumvention aspect, that there might be a trigger that can make that kind of a difficult area to negotiate.
Yeah, indeed. This is one of the projects I've been working on actually since the DMCA was passed. It was passed while I was in law school. Excuse me. And I remember talking to a law professor, a criminal law professor actually, and saying, you know, this legislation may actually, you know, increase or encourage poor security practices. And he said, no, that wouldn't make sense. And I said, well, I don't think it's what the legislature's intended, but I believe that this may be something that we're going to see 10 years down the line when you're worried about very strong intellectual property protection laws. And yet you're also trying to innovate a product, which should be allowed under the intellectual property system. But you can't because of a technological measure, something like that, that's preventing you from doing so. And if you do it and if you break it to see what's inside, even if it's legal reverse engineering, you're not able to do that. The DMCA particularly is one of the pieces of legislation which I've been very vocal about either amending or doing away with most of it. One of the groups that we have at the Hackerspace that I actually was very interested in working with is a car computer group. And it's really a group of people that not only want to improve performance on the cars that, you know, they've purchased that they own, but we'd like to do some research into how the car computers work. Information such as what is it storing about you? You know, most cars have GPS built in, especially if you have like OnStar, something like that. You know, how is it recording my location? It has microphones built into the car with GPS, with OnStar. You know, that can tell you a lot too. So looking into how these things work would be interested. We're interested in working on that. But the intellectual property barriers we have, I mean, that's a group that it's going to be tough. And I've been working in accessing and researching car computer devices for over 10 years now. And I've done numerous presentations about the DMCA and how it has really inhibited a lot of my research. If it's outside of the university research system, and I am a college professor, but I have not been doing the car computer access through them. But if you're outside of a university research group and you want to share some of the work that you've done and what you've discovered, and even in your own car's computer that you purchased this car, you can't do that because there's a small layer of encryption. And I'll tell you that some of the encryption on the cars up to about 5 years ago is pretty simple, a simple challenge response. And if you break that encryption to go beyond to see what that car is, how the computer works, even if you want to improve performance on your car and you're not a licensed dealer, you don't have a license meaning from like GM or Ford, you have just violated the anti-circumvention measure of the DMCA. So when you purchase your car, this shocks a lot of people to know this, you own the tires, the metal on the car, the seats, you know, the fabric or leather, whatever. But when it comes to the stuff that's electronic, you have a license to use that. And as more systems and cars become electronic, it's very difficult for hobbyists, you know, do-it-yourself type of people, or even small mechanics. You know, they just are shops, small mechanic shops, to keep themselves in business when they're competing with the large some of the large manufacturers and dealers, where you can't even clear an error code without going to the dealer because you'll be breaking the DMCA if you do. I mean, I have a friend who's a mechanic up in Maine, and he told me that he's been working on his own on cars for 25 years. And as cars have more computers in them, it's becoming a lot more difficult for him to do his job. It's not because he can't fix the cars. He'll fix everything that's in there, but if he wants to clear the error code so the car will pass inspection, he has to then tell his clients to take their cars to another location, to the dealer, so they can clear it. And that's like over $100 for some cars, just to plug it into the computer and say error code off. And so it's really difficult. So it's one of the things I've been doing a lot with the Hackerspace community, is talking about people who are hobbyists, do-it-yourself people working with cars. So that's one of the best examples I have of how the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is really preventing you from working on or innovating or fixing your own, things that you, devices that you own. So, and it's even harder if you want to innovate. If you want to say, okay, I want to pull this computer out and I want to write my own stuff, but how do I make it talk to what's already in the car? When you have to reverse everything that's in there, it all the protocols, it takes a lot of time. So that's something we're doing at our Hackerspace. We have a lot of people. It could be one of the biggest groups at the Hackerspace. A lot of people who want to work on their cars and fix this type of stuff. And we can't, in a sense. We can do it, but if you talk to people about it and share your information, that's where you might be triggering the legal army they have at Ford or GM. And I don't think that's really fair.
No, it's certainly not fair. And I tell you that's an excellent example, because I think in my talking to a lot of people, their eyes start to glaze over when you talk about DRM and the DMCA, and they might think about it entering their lives mostly in the form of electronic media, books, music, movies, and not think it's that big a deal. So what I love about this story and the work that you're doing and the challenges, as frustrating as they are, is that it demonstrates that it's far more insidious, it's far more pervasive than that. And you used a term in one of your other anecdotes, unintended consequences. This is, I think, largely, if we had a time machine and could go back to the framers of this law, they might have thought a bit differently about this. I mean, obviously, the automotive makers like it, device makers like it, because as you're saying about the security, they can get away with doing less, they can get away with keeping things secret by having these rights of action on top of this law.
Yeah, I think that for large industry, this is, the DMCA is good for them. I believe that the legislation was initially created because of digital media, music per se. Back then, in early 2000, we were still, you know, kind of coming about the stuff with Napster, with sharing of music online. And I think they believe that, well, okay, if you break the DRM, the digital rights, whatever, the cryptographic, I think they had some holographic stuff. If you break that, it's a technological measure, and you've just triggered, potentially criminal elements of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, but definitely civil, with pretty heavy penalties. So the DMCA, most people I know who do reverse engineering or do work with a lot with innovation, they think about the DMCA and have to every day. But they don't think about it in the sense that, okay, we want to make sure that, the industry, we're not stepping on anyone else's rights. It's more like, gosh, how do I do the work that I feel like is different than what this, GM or Ford has done, and yet still be able to do this legally without them, if I set up a company with a new device for cars, I mean, how do I do that? And the licenses to do some work with the car computers particularly is extremely expensive. So if you did have an idea that interacted with cars, getting the license agreement is expensive. So it has been something that I think has sort of slowed innovation in the automotive industry. I don't think the DMCA is really being used for improving innovation in America. It's, I believe it's doing actually the opposite. It's inhibiting a lot of work, both in research and security and in technology innovation.
Worse, I think the more recent legislation has adopted this new term, counterfeiting, kind of spanning that into new spaces that bolsters this application of DRM outside of just straight up digital media. It seems like the footprint of this sort of thinking is growing to the detriment, as you point out, of innovation and creativity. One thing I wanted to ask is there any strength that you draw from you mentioned that outside of academia this can be problematic, but we see stories for those of us that follow security news of security researchers, folks presenting at hacker cons that are able to do some good in this space. Does that give you any cause for optimism? Is there any strength you can draw upon as those communities largely overlap?
Yes, in the security industry, there are people that are circumventing some of the technological measures in devices, and they present about their research at places like Black Hat, DEF CON in Las Vegas every summer. However, if seeing the presentations is one thing, but sometimes watching behind the scenes of how those presentations can come about, some speakers, and it's almost one a year, I think, at a conference called DEF CON. DEF CON's the biggest, I think, hacker conference in the U.S., perhaps in the world. And it draws about 8,000 to 10,000 people to Las Vegas for about 3 days every summer. And it's a place where people go and it share a lot of their information, everything from vulnerabilities and physical locks and lock picking to people talking about different types of routers or network vulnerabilities and new viruses and worms, things like that. And I love to go there to learn a lot about this stuff that it's great to hear. What's interesting is every year there's almost, I think it's almost every year, there definitely was the threat of one last year. There's a cease and desist order, or it's kind of like if you talk about this, it could be criminal, and we will send people to, take you as you're going to the airport, and then you'll have to answer to the feds. So some of that is from companies being afraid that if a vulnerability is discussed, that all of a sudden it's going to put a lot of people at risk immediately and the company won't have time to patch it. And this is one of the fields of law that I've done some work in, is how to reveal or disclose information. Either do all out disclosure, like you just go to DEF CON, don't give the vendor any notice, you go talk about it, to different variations of what is called, often called, responsible disclosure, or phased responsible disclosure, where you'll just tell the vendor certain parts of what you're going to discuss, but not the whole thing. And enough for them to fix or patch their problems before you talk about the vulnerabilities. I think that sharing this type of information about vulnerabilities is good for the industry, and it's good for the vendors to hear some of this research as well. And there, every year though, it is challenging both from an intellectual property standpoint and also from some criminal law elements, that there are threats that people get, like you can't talk about this. Sometimes talks gets pulled. Or presentations get pulled from the schedule because people are threatened with either criminal and or civil litigation if they do talk about things. And it brings into play a lot of questions about the First Amendment. How much can you talk about? When you tie in the First Amendment with, like, oh, a lot of things, including maybe parts of national infrastructure, electric meters are a big deal right now. You know, nuclear power plants, their security with Stuxnet. And how can you talk about these things and share, like, hey, I found this out. It's kind of a big deal. I want to tell people so you can fix your problem, to, oh, if I tell everyone about this, there could be, you know, there could be thousands of, malicious hackers, like, on this, like, within minutes. So it's a very interesting ethical policy, even political and legal kind of ramifications that go on behind the scenes when people come to me and say, hey, I want to talk about this, but I don't know if I can or I don't know if I should. So I'm very glad to see that this work is going on at DEF CON, but sometimes things almost don't go, and sometimes they don't. 2 years ago, a talk was pulled completely, and it just, that type of stuff is sad to see in a way, because I want to see people talk about their work. But then again, it's a balance that people need to make is this really going to help the public or hurt the public by discussing this right here, right now?
There are two things that occurred to me in listening to your wonderful description of this problem that the hacker conventions very often face on a lot of these researchers and individuals. The first is the kind of well-worn dictum about certain limitations on free speech, that the right to free speech doesn't mean you can yell fire in a theater. And as you use that example of Stuxnet and the SCADA systems, a lot of these infrastructural control systems, that really does raise that question of where is that line of safety. And then the other thing, though, one of the responses to, I've heard one of the critiques of kind of non-disclosure, of letting the companies have too much lead in how they handle it, is just because we don't talk about it doesn't mean that attackers aren't talking about it and developing this information and these skills. They may already know about a lot of this stuff. So presuming that suppressing that speech at DEF CON or something like that is going to suppress all knowledge of an exploit of how to take advantage of vulnerabilities, in some ways kind of foolish.
Yeah, this was discussed. In fact, last week, Sony had to answer to Congress about, you know, some of the recent malicious hacks that they've had to endure. And one of the executives from Sony said, we can't talk about exactly how this occurred. We believe this is an unknown vulnerability. I think he's talking about, actually, I think a lot of companies, I don't know how it is with Sony, but say that initially to kind of make the press back off and say, listen, we did our best. We wouldn't have known. This was totally brand new. No one knew. But they said that we can't talk about the specifics of how this hack occurred because we're going to make a lot of other companies vulnerable if we do. So I had some interesting debates about this. In fact, when I read this, one of the, you know, that statement from a Sony executive, it's exactly what we're talking about here, is if there are other companies that are going to be, you know, don't know about this or how this occurred, it's totally brand new, maybe it would be best to share it. And maybe just not within a very enclosed network of the companies in which the CEOs of Sony, you know, associate. Maybe there are smaller companies that have some type of similar network set up that will be vulnerable. And if it was discussed publicly, everyone could fix it. So it's an interesting balance, and I don't. There hasn't been enough that's come out with the Sony case, really, for me to make a statement exactly. I don't know what happened. Very specifically, I just don't know the specifics. I don't think anyone does outside of Sony, but hopefully we will, and hopefully they'll discuss this is how it happened, this is how we fixed it, and this is how you can make sure if your company has a setup, it won't happen to you. So this is a very interesting balance, and one of the most fascinating things that I find when I go to DEF CON and Black Hat is when people are talking about these vulnerabilities and it's brand new. It's interesting to see how the industry responds, how the press responds, and how that researcher came to making their decision about, did you give the vendor notice or not that you're giving this talk? If so, how much? And I've heard the other side of the coin is if you tell the vendor and do what's called a responsible disclosure about security vulnerabilities, some vendors say, okay, thank you very much, we'll fix it within the next 12 months. And for some of the security researchers, they feel like the vulnerability they've discovered is very high risk to people who use these systems, whatever. So, but now that they've told the vendor, for them to come out publicly, or if it gets leaked, they're probably going to be the first person who's asked by that vendor, hey, this came out, do you know anything about it? Some of the vendors do initiate criminal investigations when their O-date or zero-date, as they call it, when they're hit with them. And for those of you who don't know, that means that when your systems or whatever you've created is someone finds an unknown vulnerability in it and then writes an exploit, and it's really opened up. And you have that's some of the vendors really they don't handle that quite well, especially with Sony. That's I've heard that they're not even going to get stuff back up within like this week, maybe next week. So yeah, it's fascinating to see this happening in these discussions at DEF CON and Black Hat. So same in the hacker spaces, this type of research and people discussing how they did it or how legally or ethically, you should do it. That's something that I do enjoy. And every hackerspace I've been to has discussions where people who are interested are talking about these and doing presentations. I do every now and then too. So it's definitely a topic and a subject of which I'm very passionate about, is how do you tell people that something's wrong? And or do you not tell them and release it so they fix it really fast? So it's a question of it's ethics and law.
I really appreciate you being willing to go so far afield, as it turns out, it's not that far afield that these things are, as they so often are, heavily interrelated. That pretty much covers a lot of what I wanted to talk to you about, and then some. I would like to give you a chance. So are there any projects or events coming up that you'd like to promote and share?
Right now at the hackerspace, things are a little bit quiet as we're moving like more toward the summertime. But I'm hoping we'll be doing some more stuff like car computer research. One of the directors of the hackerspace has the Chevy Volt. And what's interesting about this is it's an all-electric car. And it was advertised as being unhackable. Now, while I understand from their advertising, this is not an invitation, but it is going to be interesting to look at why they're calling it unhackable. And some of the vulnerabilities with the batteries, it has a lot of batteries in the back. We're looking at improving maybe some of the safety with the batteries. And not to say the Volt's unsafe, but we're going to be doing some research to see exactly how the batteries work. Let's put it that way. And also about how to make it go longer. We discovered with the Chevy Volt, unless you read the SEC filing for Chevy Volt, it doesn't really work very well in the winter. And this is Northern Virginia. It's not like we live in Maine. But we only got, I think, about 15 to 20 miles per charge in the wintertime here. And Chevy Volt advertises it, you can go like, about 100 miles on a charge when the weather is good. And you had to read the SEC filing about that. And I thought that was a little bit unfair advertising on Chevy's part. So we're going to be doing a little bit of research on their Volt just to see what we can find out. So again, it's going to be an interesting technological and legal project that we're working on. So if anyone in the Northern Virginia area is interested in that type of project, or working on some art installations people are doing, or with 3D printing. We have two 3D printers right now, Z-Corp printers, and we have a couple of MakerBots from you met Bree at 3D DC. So we have some MakerBots we're working on with different types of things we can do. So that's really the only thing that that's really coming up that we're working on this summer at the Hackerspace. But But yeah, there's some great hacker conferences going on almost every month in the, across the U.S. So if some of your listeners are interested, I encourage you to go to some of the conferences and find a hackerspace that's near you and see some of the projects that they're working on. They're generally, the hackerspaces are made up of very welcoming, like friendly people so that want to share their work. So, but thanks very much for doing this interview. I'm sure. Always very happy to talk about hackerspaces and education and law.
If people want to learn more about Reverse Space and about the work that you're doing, where's the best place they can go to do so?
Well, right now, reversespace.com is where we have a website. We have a Google Groups that also is pretty informative of what's going on at space right now. And if anyone wants to reach me, my email is Tiffany, T-I-F-F-A-N-Y, at reversespace.com. And I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone has about stuff on the podcast or about getting you in touch with how to find a hackerspace in your area. And one of the good ways, in fact, is to go to hackerspaces or hackerspace.org. Actually, I can't remember if there's a plural or not, but that's where there's a list of all the hackerspaces in the world, actually.
I'll find the correct link for that. I'll include that in the show notes. That's a fantastic tip. Thank you.
Great. Sure. You're welcome.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today, Tiffany. It was a real pleasure getting a chance to talk to you.
Great. Thanks very much. And thanks for coming out to 3DDC as well.
Sure. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. The next show should go out in the feed Sunday night, as usual. It'll be a newscast. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.